system.
Is there a little delay? She says it's okay now.
Yeah.
Well, just get the gavel once and open.
Open the Senate Interim Finance and Revenue Committee.
The committee and the House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We have an agenda this morning, but I'm going to take the chair's prerogative to interrupt the agenda for just a moment to introduce our newest member, Representative Rob Noce from Portland, and ask him if he'd like to introduce himself.
Sure. I'm Representative Rob Noce. I'm from Southeast Portland. I'm filling out the remainder of Representative Jules Bailey's term, and I'm pretty excited to be here, actually. This is a pretty important committee, and the work that it does is pretty important, and I know that the folks in my district care a lot about the work that this committee does, obviously, because of its impact on schools and services. So I'm excited to be here and learn, and thanks for having me here.
Thank you, Representative, very much. And now we'll go on along with our agenda and hear from the Office of Economic Analysis. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for having us for our quarterly outlook. Yet again, we always look forward to it. Hopefully, we won't be able to crush Representative Noce's enthusiasm right away. It won't take long.
I'll let you know.
Hopefully, we'll make it through today.
All right.
So, to cut to the chase in terms of the revenue and the economic outlook, number one, there's really not much change in percentage terms in terms of the general fund revenues or the employment outlook. But number two, what changes there are more red than black. And this can cause some consternation out there among folks I talk to. Well, how can this be? You know, isn't the economy improving? And yes, it most certainly is. But I have a big communication problem, and I've always had trouble communicating the difference in this outlook of an unchanged forecast and a flat forecast, which really aren't the same things. And hopefully this committee, you'll humor me and listen to the explanations of more, who can help communicate with the rest of the legislature and the public where I'm falling short. This is a savvy group that understands these things much better than most. The unchanged forecast, or how much the forecast changes, is really what policymakers are most interested in. How do we have more, or do we expect more or fewer resources than we did 3 months ago in terms of the change? So this, in terms of funding public services, has our ability to fund public services gone up or down relative to the last forecast? And that's really what we focus on in most of these numbers. But it doesn't really tie one-to-one with the underlying economy. If we have unchanged revenues, it certainly doesn't say anything about them being flat. Suppose, for example, you were in a deep recession and we expect revenues to fall 20% year over year. That's certainly not flat. Things are bad. Well, if 3 months from now we say, well, things are not quite as bad as we thought, we now expect the revenues to fall by 19% per year. Well, that's going to be a positive forecast. That's going to be a positive change. There's going to be a delta in terms of saying, okay, you now have 20, 50 million more additional resources to spend on projects or on public services. But yet it says really nothing about the underlying trends that are going on. So right now we're in the opposite situation.
That's a relief.
Where the changes are a little negative for the most part relative to the last forecast, but there's a whole lot of growth built in now. The Oregon economy is certainly taking off, particularly relative to other states. While the U.S. is still waiting to accelerate, Oregon's employment and income growth has started picking up about a year ago. And now we've regained our traditional growth advantage vis-a-vis other states. Here you see job growth is now approaching 3%. And in terms of relative to the U.S., which is the orange chart, we're up about a percent or more, percentage point or more faster than the rest of the country. And This is no surprise. As usual, we fell further, and now we're climbing faster than does the rest of the country. And this has a lot to do with our dependence on resource industries and manufacturing, and even more so, our dependence on migration. When there are job opportunities here, we typically get a lot of folks moving in, and not only does that support labor for our firms and affordable skilled labor for our firms, but it also provides a lot of demand for our consumer services and retail industries and the like. So we tend to go quicker in recoveries, and that's what we're seeing. And a lot of this really presents itself in the regional pattern, which my colleague Josh is going to describe.
Representative Barnhart, members of the committees. For the record, Josh Lander, Office of Economic Analysis. And Mark mentioned that we've seen this acceleration in Oregon's job growth. Primarily, it is occurring at the regional level. Portland metropolitan area popped up first, 2011 or so, has been growing pretty steady since. They've regained all their jobs that they lost during the recession. Only the Columbia River Gorge counties and the Portland metropolitan area are at the point where they've regained all of their losses. But you can see in the dark blue line, the other metropolitan areas in the state are where the acceleration has really been seen. Eugene, Bend, and Salem in particular are now growing as fast today pretty much as they did back during the housing boom. They fell further than the typical counties in the state, and they were flat for a few years with no improvements as the economic expansion started across the state. However, in the last couple years, they've really turned the corner. That's where the acceleration is coming from. So the geographic footprint of the recovery is more spread out. Now, our rural communities, or at least our non-metropolitan counties, are seeing some acceleration in job growth. However, they have moved from zero job growth up to about 1% job growth, which is half of what they saw during the housing boom. They typically saw a little bit more than 2% job growth. So we are seeing, again, the recovery spread to more counties. However, the strength of it is still concentrated in the metropolitan areas, even though we're seeing improvements by and large in most counties. The next graph is a little bit more complicated in that it shows on the horizontal axis how far each of these counties fell during recession. And then the vertical axis, what share of the jobs have they regained? Again, you can see a lot of the Portland counties and Gorge counties, Hood River and Wasco and the like, plus Corvallis. Up at the top, they've regained all the jobs that they lost. In the next tier, in some of the blue counties, you're seeing this acceleration in some of the next tier counties, the medium-sized metropolitan areas in the state and the like. However, where we're seeing the smallest improvements, again, are in some of our southern counties, our more rural communities. They've regained a tenth or a quarter or even up to a third of their job gains. However, there's been a little bit of growth across the state. And by and large, the further you fell, the slower your recovery to date, if you kind of look at this. If you had a smaller than average recession, you've had a better than average recovery. So we're kind of getting this divergence here, with the one exception being Deschutes County, Central Oregon more broadly, but Deschutes being the biggest one with Bend there. And on the next graph, you can really see this recovery. Bend in particular and Crook and Jefferson counties as well have really started to accelerate in the last 2 years. They're growing at 5% or nearly 5% a year for the last 2 years, which is on par, again, with the housing booms. And a lot of this has come due to the return of population growth in migration from out of state. And some of the associated housing activity that goes along with that. If you do some rough estimates of housing, new home construction relative to population growth, Bend no longer has excess supply. You talk about the housing bubble that they experienced there, and it was larger than every single city in the country except for 1%. They were only 1% of cities across the country had a larger housing bubble than Bend. But with the population growth that they've seen and the low levels of new home construction in recent years, they've whittled through all of that excess inventory, and now that population growth has returned a little bit, we're seeing a sharp acceleration increase in economic activity in Central Oregon, which is good news because they had the deepest recession in the state just a couple years ago, and now that we're seeing improvement there, it is good news for the regional economy.
Yeah, and population growth is really everything. For Oregon, and we had quite a bit of a scare over the last 2 or 3 years because population data is very lagged in coming. We don't get very timely data on population. It takes a long time to collect. But what we saw during the housing crash and the years afterwards is we had some of this. Our traditional migration trends were short circuited. A lot of our flows that we typically get when we have a unemployment rate advantage vis-a-vis California, which we have, we didn't see this time, and we saw flows of population into the state, really at at record lows in a lot of places. Even a place like Bend, we saw absolutely flatline in terms of population growth, which is rare indeed. So one of the things we've been keeping our eye on, since this is our comparative advantage and leads to a lot of Oregon's growth advantage in good times, is have we started to see this come back? And all indications are yes. That if the Bend data wasn't enough to convince you, we look at a bunch of other leading indicators, school enrollment, van line data, and in particular here, the DMV records we're seeing here. These are driver's license surrendered. Half of which come from either California or Washington in a typical year. And as you see here, we've finally over the last year or two seen some gains and are back up on the 70,000 driver's license turned in rate that we were at in the last economic expansion. So this is good news. It appears that our comparative advantage is back, and it's not just good news for the cities, it's good news for really almost every region of Oregon and the state. If this chart is about domestic net migration, and in my past life as a regional economist, I used to always say that if I could only pick one indicator out of all of them for the vitality of a metropolitan area, it would be net domestic migration. It would be, can you draw more people from elsewhere in the state and other states to your area than you lose? People are really voting with their feet. And if people want to come to your area, that is really the heart of vitality. And as such, Oregon is an extremely vital place. Here, this chart, although difficult to read, tries to show net domestic migration both from within other areas of Oregon and other states. So as we move left to right, on the x-axis, we're looking at net migration from other places in Oregon, and as we go north and south, it's from other areas of the state. So as you see here, the only ones south of the zero line there typically are our smaller eastern Oregon towns, and those are different in a fundamental way than the rest of the state insofar as these are places that their advantage is not in drawing migrants from other states in the country, but rather drawing migrants from other countries. This is a domestic migration picture for those smaller areas in Representative Bent's district and the like. Their comparative advantage really is in drawing migrants from outside. So as you go left to right, the bubbles on the farther right side typically are our suburbs and our exurbs in the state. As population flows out of the urban centers and into some of the suburbs and exurbs, those are the places that do best in terms of drawing other Oregonians. But as we go north to south, the picture is a little bit different. And this has a lot to do with folks coming in from California. In particular, a lot of those green ones up there are some of our struggling rural economies in the south and on the coast and in central Oregon. And what's unique about these is that the amount of folks that they're bringing in from California and other states is fully offsetting and even more so than the folks that they're losing to Portland and Salem and Eugene and the Valley, as folks losing their working age population and some of the working age households, they're being replaced by often retiree households from California, which are a little bit of a different mix. But although things are different, that is really, really unique. When you look at a place like Coos County that took the shock that they did to their natural resources and goods providers, that was on the order of, in terms of the job losses as a share, we're looking at what Detroit suffered. And some of the ones that were historically even more tied to resource industries like Curry County and Lincoln County, those losses were more on the lines of Youngstown, Ohio. So really, really bleak picture in terms of, the comparison here. We're looking at some of the most struggling metropolitan areas in the country. But all of these, whether they be in the Rust Belt or in the old Farm Belt or in the southern textile towns, any metropolitan area that's lost taken this kind of hit in their goods producers is bleeding population all across the country, with the exception of a lot of our rural areas. And so this is really special, in particular since, like I say, this is really a great sign of vitality. You know, the fact that Coos County and Jackson County, Josephine, Curry, Lincoln, Douglas, Klamath, all these places are adding people in the typical year. Now, again, the mix is a little different. So we have to, as we go forward, we have to look at being able to exploit this. As these folks move up here, a lot of these folks don't have current income, and they aren't necessarily bringing their labor supply like young working families do, and we understand their impact on the economy. Instead, a lot of time, these folks are bringing with them wealth. And it's important for us going forward to be able to exploit this, both in terms of funding public services as well as providing impetus for economic growth. So I'm going to skip ahead some of the migration stuff to get to the outlook so that we can move on to revenues here shortly.
Thanks, Mark. We talked about earlier the acceleration in Oregon's jobs up to over 40,000 a year on a year-over-year basis, 2.5 to 3%, depending upon the exact month you're talking about. Is this as good as it gets? And unfortunately, the answer we get from our advisors and from our models and things like that and talking with some folks is we expect this to be about as good as things get in this recovery, not quite all the way up to what we've seen in previous expansions. Previously, we talked about the growth being more of a three-quarters throttle for the Oregon economy relative to our historical expansions. Right now, we're maybe a little bit stronger than that, 80 to 90% throttle. And we think that'll continue for the next couple years before some of the longer-term demographic trends weigh on it as the baby boomers start to age out of their prime working years and into their retirement years. It's a slow process that'll take a decade or two. These things don't happen overnight. However, we do think there will be some slower growth over the extended horizon. The question is how much strength, how long does this 2.5 to 3% job growth last? That provides some upside risk to the 2015-17 outlook. If we think it'll continue a little bit stronger than it is, that can provide some upside risk. However, what we're seeing across the country is a slowdown in the Northeast and the Midwestern states. We've seen a deceleration there in job growth. We've seen an acceleration in the Southern states and the West Coast, Oregon included. And Oregon's a little bit stronger than the typical acceleration state. So right now, again, we don't think there'll be another fundamental increase in the growth rate. We think this might be about as good as it gets for the next couple years, and that's where we are today.
So where we are in terms of the revenue tracking is a little more complicated. And we got through the first half of the biennium. June was the end of fiscal year 2014. And at that point, through the first half here, we are tracking right about on the close of session forecast. We're looking at less about 0.1% or $7 million off of the close of session forecast for the first half of the biennium. So that's all good news that everything is really, so far in terms of what we have in the door, its revenues are matching pretty much exactly the outlook. But what's not matching is our outlook for the current fiscal year, fiscal year 2015, that will end next June. Over this past year, we've become more optimistic about the prospect for economic and revenue growth. And in addition, we've enacted some revenue increases, the legislature did, in between the main odd year sessions, which also factor in to our kicker formula and the like. And so as a result, right now with the September forecast for personal income taxes, the increased optimism has pushed us right south of the 2% kicker threshold. We're about just a little bit, $27 million south. You see here in this graph, the dark blue section is the $93 million in additional revenue that was added during the special session, which has put us a little closer to the threshold, but the floor is increased as well. In terms of expenditures, we're also increased during the special and February sessions, leaving us not a lot of wiggle room on the bottom either. So what this means practically is that for policymakers, that in terms of your resources for the current biennium, this is about as good as it can possibly get. Should we, whether we miss on the high side or the low side, at this point, chances are there will be fewer resources available. If we miss on the high side, the kicker will come into play, and we'll take roughly $300 million at least away from
revenues in the next biennium. It's part of it'll be paid as a credit on taxes in April 2016, if there is one. Or if we go down, we're looking at a $250 million balance right now in terms of wiggle room on the south side. So hopefully we can stay in this sweet spot, but there's a long way to go until I get there. And again, there's this distinction between flat and unchanged. Here we're saying we're $27 million away from a kicker. We're really, to be accurate, we're $7.5 billion away from a kicker because we haven't seen any of this revenue yet for 2015, and this is all really based on prospective revenue that hasn't come in. So where does that put us? Well, that would be about $600 million more than last year. To get to that kicker, we're going to have to get $600 million more than last year, somewhere around a pretty good year, 8% growth along those lines. If we only get $350 million more than last year, well, then we're going to need to make budget reductions because that's going to be short of our outlook. So just trying to articulate again that while, you know, this we have this razor-thin margin here in terms of the kicker, we've set the bar particularly high. And we're expecting it's going to take a really big year to get there, although we now expect one to occur. In terms of the recent performance of our personal income taxes, we saw a real slowdown at the end of the filing period this year, and it had to do with weakness in non-wage forms of income. In particular, capital gains and the like. I've told this story many times to this group. In 2012, we saw a burst of realizations of taxable gains and the like as investors tried to get out in front of federal tax increases. Then in 2013, which is reflected in this graph, payments in April 2014, we saw the opposite. There was a hangover there where there was very few taxable non-wage forms of income cashed in at the end of the year. But that said, while we're seeing overall deceleration because of those non-wage forms of income, there is good news in the personal income accounts, and particularly with the wage income and withholdings out of paychecks, which is really the core of what we collect from month to month. And those are showing a lot of healthy growth and haven't slowed down or shown any of the weakness that recent employment surveys in the state have. So that's encouraging and suggests that at its heart, the personal income tax is doing well. But the tricky part, as always, is what about these non-wage forms of income? Will this hangover continue into next year? Where will the stock market be in December 31st, in terms of generating potentially taxable gains? And here you see we are expecting a big year this year in April. In order to get to this, shade under a kicker outlook, we expect a big 23% year-over-year increase in April, and that would be one of the largest on record that we have seen, similar to what happened in the housing boom and the tech boom. A couple years ago, as a pull forward, we did see similar as well. Luckily enough, we were close on that outlook in terms of a 20% year-over-year growth rate. But again, we're bitten by the flat and the unchanged. I was very tickled with us when we got the 25% right, but then the new wet behind the ears beat writer for the Oregonian at the time wrote, well, it's not real when revenues are flat, it's not real hard to forecast them.
Now I understand why you're emphasizing this point.
Yeah, well, here we are again, flat versus unchanged. I've been beat up over the last couple months about this, so I'm a little sore. I apologize. This picture I haven't had out for you all it took me a couple years back to find it. But this one really kind of highlights the difference between the flat and the unchanged. Although these numbers have real budgetary implications when we're talking about $50, $70, $80 million here from a
from a qualitative perspective, there's really little change in our outlook for personal income taxes here. You see, qualitatively, the outlook is still showing quite a bit of growth. Looks like a healthy straight line up, up, up. But that said, most of these are red in terms of how much this has changed relative to 3 months ago. It has been.
So we're growing like crazy, but because you predicted it, it's a flat forecast.
That's right, Representative Barnhart, exactly. So I will stop beating that dead horse, and we'll move on to corporate collections, which are booming. We've seen over the last few months now, as you see here, we're looking at 75% year over year for the last 3 months of the corporate excise taxes. And this was good because we started the biennium so weak, or the first year so weak in terms of corporate profit, at least weak relative to our expectations, that those last few months have made it all up. So now we're at a position where we're only $10 million below the close of session forecast for corporate taxes. That's about 1% short. But even though we're 1% short, again, due to technicalities, we are actually calling for a corporate kicker now of the rated $43 million corporate kicker. Now, the corporate kicker was reformed, so it no longer goes back as a credit to businesses, but rather will be dedicated to K-12 spending in 15-17 should this be realized. So why are we below forecast by a percent and still getting a kicker? Well, part of the special session reforms had to do with the size of the rainy day fund deposit out of our minimum tax, our Measure 67 minimum corporate tax. That transfer into the rainy day fund was reduced for the current biennium, and as a result, more of the revenues are being kept within the general fund and are therefore under the umbrella of the kicker law. So we reduced that transfer into the rainy day fund by $53 million, so that's increased the general fund revenues by $53 million above what was expected. So but again, that really in terms of revenue impact has been muted. It's really an expenditure story for the ways and means to allocate going forward.
Dr. Richard.
In terms of going forward on the corporate excise tax forecast, this one is both flat and unchanged. We have, our outlook for corporate income taxes is somewhere flat here in the $500 to $500 million a year, or $500 to $550 million a year from here on out. And this is one that keeps me up at night. Most of our history of corporate taxes, we saw, of course, terribly volatile, but they swung around an average of $350 million a year from the mid-90s until this decade. They would be half of that or double that in any given year, but there was really no growth over time to speak of. But since then, there have been a lot of things going on, not the least of which being the Great Recession. But we had the Great Recession, messes up all of our numbers, and then along with it, we got a string of major tax reforms, which I've highlighted here, most of which, aside from the small business tax cut, which may accelerate this shift out of C-Corps into pass-through entities, but most of these are revenue-increasing changes in the law. And as a result, we're going to land somewhere north of the $350 million a year. Here we see around $500 and $550 million. Now, this landing place was about a year ago. I did a real careful analysis of all the LRO impact estimates for these various reforms to come up with the estimate of the landing place. I'm going to revisit that with any new updated work they have before the December forecast, which will go into the governor's recommended budget, and of course before the May outlook for the odd year session for the legislature. So we'll revisit this, but for now we're looking at a step up relative to history. Now, that of course, the historical volatility, those swings up and down, we can't put in the forecast because it's hard to time those swings. But that's not always damning. In fact, you see that huge swing in 2010, the 09-11 biennium is a great example of that, where it was one of our most accurate corporate forecasts ever, but it was about, 100% too high in the first year, and then 50% too low in the second year, and those things canceled out and ended up right on right on at the end of the biennium. And that's sort of, I guess, what we're hoping with our flat outlook. But really, the nature of this is to say we expect in the average year more corporate revenue than we've seen in the past, and that's really tied to these legislative changes. And hopefully, as these play out and we get more data on the impacts of these changes, we'll have a better idea of where our landing space will be. Now, looking forward now into 15-17, the next biennium, which we're just about to, as I said, set the governor's recommended budget baseline. The major downside risk is not a general fund risk, but a lottery fund risk. And Josh is our resident lottery expert who will describe this to y'all.
Thanks, Mark. What you see in front of you is the video lottery sales within the Oregon Lottery jurisdiction versus slot machines in Las Vegas versus slot machines in the rest of Nevada. And you can see they fell 20 to 25% during the Great Recession, and they've only come back very slowly since. The annualized growth rate in the last 4 years for Oregon Video Lottery is 1.25%, somewhere in there, between 1 and 1.5%. And that is actually a good gaming revenue growth rate relative to the rest of the country. Whether you're talking about Las Vegas, or you're talking about Atlantic City in New Jersey, or the Connecticut casinos, or on the Gulf Coast down in Louisiana, Mississippi, everywhere that has these established gaming markets are seeing very low growth rates or flat-out declines continue. The only places that are seeing gaming growth are brand-new casinos. They put a new one in Indiana. They put a new one in downtown Philadelphia. They put a new one in Maryland just a year ago. And now Massachusetts is about to get into it. This year or next year, they're going to put in 3 casinos. Those are the only places that you're seeing growth, and a lot of that has to do with cannibalization. The pie, the whole expenditure for consumers and households on gaming isn't growing. It's more of a cannibalization within that industry. So the lottery is at risk in terms of our outlook. We've had acceleration built into the lottery forecast, not huge acceleration, going from this 1.5% growth rate up to 2 to 3 to 4% over the 10-year horizon, which is still below the rates of personal income gains. So as a share of consumer spending, as a share of households' budgets, it's continuing to decline, but maybe just not quite at this growth rate that we've seen. We haven't moved our full outlook, our baseline, to this 1% growth scenario or 1.5% growth scenario. However, we are contemplating that. We have a conference coming up in the next couple months where we get to talk with some of our counterparts across the country about some of their gaming views and what they're seeing locally. I just have sort of the data looking at all these state comparisons, and it's not exactly the growth industry it once was. So after a few years of this really slow growth, we're contemplating moving our baseline down further, which would be a reduction of available resources. A lot of it goes to debt service and to the state school fund, let alone to parks and things like that. So it will have big implications moving forward if we were to lower this growth rate. But so far we are still maintaining there'll be a little improvement in this up to, again, to 2 or 3, topping out at 4% growth rate over 10-year horizon. But by and large, it is not the growth industry it once was and potentially maybe never will be again.
It's getting harder and harder to wait for the improvement in the lottery, as we're seeing spending on all sort of discretionary spending on all sorts of other things come back in the last couple of years, along with the economy. People are spending a lot more on ice cream and the like and other luxury goods, but not gaming. And so it does appear that there's a fundamental change here. So in terms of the bottom line for the current biennium, here you see net available resources for the current biennium has been bumped up by $86 million. That's offset somewhat by $16 million fewer in lottery funds. This increase is about evenly spread between personal and corporate income taxes. We saw the big boom in the corporate income taxes over the past couple of months. This is
now carried forward into the outlook. And in terms of personal income tax, we've seen some decent growth again in the withholdings out of wages and salaries recently, and have reason to believe that we're going to have a couple of some large realizations of capital gains over the next several months that will also support near-term revenues. But longer term, most of them are down. Here we see the forecast changes going forward. Again, from the personal income tax side, that not terribly big as a percentage. From lottery is here really in terms of our declines in future biennia. The culprit are evenly matched between a downgrade in the personal income tax forecast and in the lottery forecast. But as a base, of course, the personal income tax is 15 times larger than the lottery. So the lottery is really a significant change here going forward, and at risk of a similar sized decrease perhaps next time if things don't turn around soon. So where does
now,
that
before oh, you yes. before you go on? This is an adjustment from an earlier forecast that showed increases. Is that correct?
That's correct. For the lottery,
I want to go back to your original theme. For
yes,
just a second.
Yes. In the chain, for the lottery, it wasn't much increase. We never thought that spending on gaming was going to grow at the same pace as spending on everything else. It's a and particularly for one provider, being the Oregon Lottery. It's a horribly competitive industry, with folks attacking from all sides, and that and the demographic changes that might affect demand. We always felt that it was going to have a smaller and smaller impact on your spending. Here you see as a share of personal income, how much is being spent on video lottery. And we always had it going down. We're not spending as much on lottery as everything else, but now it appears we're going to get to really all-time lows, back to shares that we saw before the line games were introduced and the like. And so we always had a somewhat, pessimistic outlook in terms of lottery growth, but not a flat outlook. As you see here, we've been looking at about 1% a year since the Great Recession, 1.5% a year. And so if that's the new normal, that would be yet another step down. If we're saying that from now on all we can get is 1.5% at best, that would be an additional step down.
Now, I guess the point I was trying to make certain I understood, with the possible exception of the lottery, these other decreases you're talking about are decreases in the rate of growth rather than absolute decreases.
Yes, Representative Barnhart. For the most part, all of our revenues, for the most part, are growing. There are some that are falling, cigarette revenues and the like, but all the major streams are expected to grow.
Thank you.
So, one more request before I open it up for questions would be articulating to the legislature when you guys get back together about the risks involved here and the uncertainty in this forecast. Those of you who have been on the committee for a long time realize exactly how volatile these streams can be, and the importance of supporting budgetary reserves. Here is our budgetary reserve outlook. And in order to get enough money to take a typical recession, one of the order of the 2000-2001 tech bust, in order to weather that for a biennium, we need about 7% cushion, or 1.2 today, 1.4 in the future, $1 billion put away, which is quite big, but that's consistent with the standard deviation of our revenue stream, as well as the literature out there across states about what's a reasonable reserve. Problem is, that's pretty hard to build. As you see here, we've never really saved more than $500 million before. In any one given biennium, but we are expected to do so going forward. But that expectation has a lot to do with policy. In particular, we have this automatic transfer into the rainy day fund of our ending balance up to 1% of expenditures in the previous biennium.
here in our baseline assumptions, we're assuming that the legislature keeps an ending balance that's at least that large and then pushes that forward into the next year, as they did this biennium. But that said, that doesn't happen every year, particularly when there's need. So even under these rosy assumptions where the legislature saves as much as possible in terms of their discretion, it still takes until the end of the 17-19 biennium until we have adequate reserves to really take a recessionary blow. I polled the governor's advisors of economic advisors last month about, okay, if you were to bet on when the next recession is going to come, when would it be? And there was a real tight consensus around 3 to 5 years out. So this is just about shy of that 3 to 5 years out. So if any acceleration in spending would be welcomed by, saving would be welcomed by our office. And finally, as always, the 10-year forecast, the main thing here is that we slow down in the out years, reflecting our aging population and the labor force trends we're seeing, that we don't expect to be able to maintain the same 15 or 16% growth in a expanding biennium that we've seen in a typical year. Instead, we're expecting more on the order of 10% in a typical biennium going forward as growth overall slows. And so with that, I'd like to thank you, and if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Senator Hatch,
thank
please.
You. On slide 15, if there is ever a clear visual of the volatility of our income tax heavy system, I think this would be it. This would be what Paul Warner and I used to call the Swiss Alps of Oregon's tax code. But that's about as clear as you can get, and shows the need for a more diverse tax code.
Thank you, Senator.
Representative Reed, and then Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to pick up on that same theme. You mentioned at one point in your presentation that you're anticipating some increased revenue from capital gains in the next period of time. I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit.
One is obviously the equity market growth. We have seen quite a bit of increase. Those hold through December 31st. We'll be in pretty good shape. And there are some other idiosyncratic one-time events that we're also factoring in.
A brief comment, Mr. Chair. I would commend to the committee a report that Dr. Warner brought to our attention from Pew on the approach various other states take to their reserve funds. And one of the key points that they make is the importance of identifying anomalous or one-time infusions of income and the importance of putting them into rainy day funds. As we anticipate that, what might be characterized as unusual or one-time occurrences, I think we'd do well to remember the rainy day fund.
Thank you, Representative. Senator.
Thank you. We didn't plan this in advance, but I wanted to build on Senator Hass's and Representative Reed's comments. If we were able to do what some other states have done and, for example, find a way to sequester the capital gains revenue into the rainy day fund or somewhere out of the general fund, what would that do to your forecasting accuracy?
Madam Chair, I'd like to think it would improve it greatly. That obviously this is very difficult to forecast, not only because it can increase or drop by 50% in a given year, but also because it's not necessarily coordinated with the underlying economic activity that generated all this, taxable wealth. It's about the behavior of taxpayers when they choose to cash it in, and that can have, all sorts of different factors rather than, the economy stuff that we track. So So it is. It would certainly help, and it would reduce the volatility of our revenue stream significantly. What the plan that you describe is one that they've recently put in place in Massachusetts. It has a very income tax heavy state that has a lot of this non-wage income fluctuations, as do we, and they have a very similar. Law in place now where they take any of this excess capital gains related income and stow it away.
Well, there might be a chance for you to come and testify on this point during the next session.
I'd be happy to, Senator.
I think it was Representative Vance next, if I remember correctly.
Thank you, Chair. And drawing you away from this interesting discussion, which I think is interesting, to back to slide 8. And so the obvious conclusion one draws from looking at this is my district will soon be all of Eastern Oregon instead of just most of it right now, because our population continues to dwindle. The question, your remarks about the nature of the employment being the reason for that, I would probably disagree with. That may be the consequence, but the cause is the more interesting part. And so I would ask you, you've talked before about the challenge Oregon faces with its increasing age in these communities and how we need to do something about it. So why is it that these communities, in your opinion, are losing population?
Representative Bentz, again, yes, a lot of it does have to do with the demographics. These places, it's not proper English to say are aging faster than anywhere else, because I guess we're all aging at the same rate. But as a population, we're seeing this. And as these folks retire, these aren't just regular workers. These are, highly skilled workers with a lifetime of productivity, and a lifetime of experience. And so this is a real heavy weight on a lot of these areas. But unlike a lot of the stuff on the western side of the mountains, it's hard to really get there, hard to get a lot of migration from within the state. What hope there is from outside, either outside the country or outside the state. And outside the country, which isn't in this graph, is where the good news is. These are a lot of our young working age households that are in their root setting years and are perfect for economic development insofar as they're ready to, settle down, buy houses and furniture and cars and the like, and put their kids in school. So the international migration is a good story. Within the state, some of this, within the country, some of this may be overstated, excuse me, in terms of the weakness. As you see here, Columbia County, which isn't on the east, but is very vital right now. It's one of the places, as you see, gets more Oregonians, nets more Oregonians than anywhere else. A lot of the folks who retire or leave the Portland metropolitan area go out there to Columbia County, but yet it's losing population to other states, which is bizarre. You see, it's in that quadrant all by itself, Columbia County. Well, that's because it's right on the border with Washington, so it's losing population to other states. A lot of the counties in eastern Oregon face the same problems with border effects. In particular, right up next to Idaho, we see that those areas are really losing a lot of population to other states. But hopefully, in terms of the economic punch, it's not that bad, because if they're just living there and working, still providing their labor, potentially for eastern Oregon, that's not altogether bad. But yes, the population dynamics are particularly are very pronounced there, and in particular, our birth and death rates of the native population have really flipped. So that in terms of the natural rate of growth, we're seeing declines in a lot of these older areas.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
So my question again was why, not a snapshot of the situation, but why.
Why? Yes, Representative Bentz. Yes, it does have to do with this gut punch in terms of losing our resource industries and the decline of them more than anything else, I would say.
Comment?
Please. Yes.
So I'll be appearing in a League of Oregon Cities meeting to talk about industrial land issues. But I think it's important that we all understand what's happening in Malheur County, where I've lived for 37 years. and the white flight that's occurring out of it into Idaho. I think it occurs in other places, but it's obvious because I live there. And the white flight is occurring because of our land use and zoning regulations that prohibit the building of houses on bluffs and other hillsides that are in the desert, which many of some of this group saw just a few days ago. And the sad part is those with money leave and live in Idaho, and those without money stay. That's why we have such an incredible poverty rate. This slide is really great because it illustrates exactly what the consequences of two really unfortunate policies might be. One is land use, and the other is the taking off the economic table of all the space that's out there. It's really sad. And that's what I raised last night in your hearing in Hillsboro as we looked at the $100 billion being invested by Intel. So thank you for bringing this slide. I'm going to use it.
Oh, thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Knows.
Yeah, my question was just more, could you talk a little bit about why you think the rate of growth is not as robust as you maybe thought it was going to be? I'm curious about that.
Sorry, Representative Knows, you mean in terms of the near-term forecast or in the long-term why we think we're going to have a slowdown?
Why don't you go ahead and entertain with both, actually.
most of the near-term downgrade in our employment, although it's a very small one in terms of our employment outlook, feeds down from the national forecast. We've seen we use an outside vendor for our U.S. forecast model and pay attention to the consensus of forecasters out there, you know, in the country. And for the most part, those outlooks have become more pessimistic in recent months, in particular after we had a real ugly GDP report, and which, you know, was partly weather-related and part of the country, but nevertheless, after that, we saw a little bit more pessimism across the country, where before everyone was expecting the U.S. as a whole to continue to accelerate in employment growth. Now the consensus is really that this is pretty much as good as it gets for the U.S., that we'll stay at somewhere around this modest rate of growth. And so as we've weakened that macroeconomic outlook, that feeds a little bit down into our state model, into this a weaker outlook for the state. So that's the near term. Longer term, it's a lot about the issues that Representative Bentz was bringing up. Again, the aging of the baby boom population cohort, as these folks go out of their peak spending and working years, it's really a weight on growth going forward, and it's going to be difficult to maintain the same growth rates we did when our labor supply was growing and we had increased participation among women and minorities and you know, more population flows and the like.
Yes, please.
So when people retire, don't people move in to take those jobs, or like I think I'm not following that.
Oh yeah, Representative Knows. Yes, there will be someone to come take those jobs, but how many, and will they be as good and as skilled? Typically, an entry level person will make less money and have less experience than the folks that they're replacing, and that puts downward pressure on our growth outlook.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just drill down on the employment picture, job growth figures, because it seems like that raw data percentage growth doesn't really tell the whole story of what it's like if you're actually somebody who's looking for a job or you're in a job that you're totally underemployed in. I mean, it seems like, and maybe you could just talk a little more about this, that there are a lot of people starting out in their careers who can't get hired at all or are taking jobs that are certainly not what they're qualified to do. So people are either working part-time, they're working at much lower wages than they would have expected. And then at the other end of the spectrum, it seems like a lot of people in their middle to later years who were hard hit and got laid off during the Great Recession have not been able to get back into the workforce at all. Or if they get back, they're really minimally employed. So I wonder, when you say job growth, is a job, or is this a more nuanced analysis?
Thank you, Senator. Yes, it's much more nuanced. In the cases you pointed out, both of young workers who are locked out of the labor market, or at least skilled jobs, and therefore aren't generating the experience that they would if they were working, as well as
older individuals who have a skills mismatch. Maybe you're in a mill town, the mill closes, you're a 50-year-old skilled mill worker, and now your skills don't match the economy. These are important because these are the ways we see that the recession can cause permanent damage to your economy. These are the way, you know, this damage doesn't go away. And to what extent, you'll hear people talking in terms of monetary policy, and there's a write-up in our report that just went out about this, about, you know, how much is about the business cycle and how much is these permanent issues. And the indications are that there's still slack in the labor market. We see unemployment rates back down close to normal. We're seeing this job growth like we saw in the, you know, housing boom, roughly, or a little bit south of that. But yet there are still indications that not all is well. And you mentioned a couple of them in terms of people working part-time who would rather be working full-time. Still elevated, but coming down slowly. People who have been long-term unemployed, worried about the skills mismatches. Still elevated, but coming down slowly. Measures of confidence, like people, the quit rate, people's ability, at what rate do people walk away from a job? You don't walk away from a job unless you think you can get something else. And that's still below normal, but improving slowly. So by most measures, there is still some slack in the labor market out there that we need to take up. Now, hopefully, we'll get most of it up, and at the end of the day, we won't have a whole lot of folks that have been left behind.
And just one follow-up, just a technical clarification. So does a part-time or temporary job count the same as a permanent full-time job in terms of when you're measuring percentage of job growth?
Yes, Senator Rosenbaum, in the typical statistics, they do. There are full-time equivalents and whatnot. But for these surveys, they'll go to a firm and say, well, how many people you got working for you? Do you have working for you today? And that can include some of this.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Vega Peterson, please.
Thank you, Chair. So thanks for the presentation, you guys. So it seems to me, going back to the discussion around the kicker, that, you know, some of the things that we're seeing right now that are putting us close to the personal kicker or that have put us over for the corporate kicker are things that would have been impossible to actually forecast 2 years ago because it was a change in tax policy that took place or the fact that money that was, you know, in one category was used for another category. And, you know, and that wouldn't have, there was, would have been really no way to forecast that because those weren't things that were part of the normal, you know, economic factors that you guys look at. So whether or not, you know, it's good for the stability of the state, which I, you know, it's not good for the stability of our system. And I'm in favor with my colleagues of looking at this further. But, you know, can you just comment on, you know, the kicker itself, how that actually works with or how the reality of how it's affected compares to the work that you do in putting the forecast together?
Thank you for the question, Representative. Our forecast, strictly by its policy, is a current law forecast. We don't put words in the legislature's mouth, no matter how obvious an upcoming law change or action is going to be. We're going to go with current law and then forecast out. And that typically isn't a problem. Except for with the kicker law, we've gotten away from the intent. The legislative intent when they created the kicker law was to say, okay, we will wash out any of these legislative changes or changing the color of money or doing the tax law. And the way they did that is created this close of session forecast. Said whatever the Office of Economic Analysis says we have in May, then we will fold in the Legislative Revenue Office's impact statements that are passed over that odd year session, and we'll call that the close of session forecast, and that will set the bar. And so operationally, that took away this problem, because then those were not as part, though any changes were counted in the kicker base.
But then since then, we've added February session in even years and sometimes special sessions. And although the intent of the law was to net out any legislative impact, the letter of the law is clear that this close of session forecast is any action taken in the main odd year session is folded in, and it's silent about these intermediate changes. And so this is really a new phenomenon. Now that we have these intermediate meetings of the legislature where they're making tax law, it is monkeying with the kicker base.
Thank you.
Other questions? I was handed a question from the audience, and I'm tempted to ask it, recognizing that you may not have much to say about this particular issue. But one of the things we've seen in the news a lot, and of course one of the things I'm very well aware of because my district includes the University of Oregon, Lane Community College, and a lot of students, is that students are incurring more and more debt in order to go to school. And one of the issues is the problem finding work that compensates adequately in order to pay student loans. Do you have any statistics you can give us this morning on the change in the length of time it takes for students to pay off their loans or default rates that you could share with us?
Yes, Representative Barner. I'm going to defer to Josh, who's done quite a bit of work with default rates across our institutions and our regions.
Thanks. It was probably 2 years ago at this time we kind of put out a couple-page report on student loan debt and the increases we had seen, partly at the request of Representative Reed from the committee as well. And we certainly have seen it. I believe student default rates are not only are they increasing, but they're higher than a lot of other types of default rates out there right now. If you look, so there have been some new research reports that have come out from some of the different Federal Reserve banks. I think the Federal Reserve Bank of New York put out a prominent one not too long ago. If you look at the whole world of student debt, it's still fairly manageable because you have those mid-career folks that are still maybe in their 30s that are still paying it off a couple hundred dollars a month as a share of income. It's not very much. The problem becomes, as you say in the question from the audience, the new people, the new graduates, or hopefully the best thing you can do if you go to college is to graduate. Don't incur all the debt and then drop out. That is the worst outcome you can have because it does not improve your job prospects, or not very much, but yet you incur the debt as well. That's also what the research shows, is that is the worst outcome. And so, you know, we don't have updated figures for that, but we do have default rates by institution within the state of Oregon, federal loans, not the private sector loans. And basically there was a correlation there with regional economic activity. If you were taking out student debt in a community college or university in a struggling community with Oregon, you had an above average default rate because a lot of these community colleges and the like are tied to the local regional economic conditions. You don't necessarily go off to a four-year institution across the country and then move to New York or something like that after that. And that's the pattern we've seen, and I'd be surprised if it's unchanged, but digging into those and updating that because they're a couple years old would probably be a good idea.
So when students default, they default because their income doesn't cover their expenses.
That is correct.
When the expense includes the payment of the student loan.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. Other questions? Representative Conger. Representative Conger's on the phone. I neglected to indicate that earlier. He's been with us the whole time. Representative, please ask your question.
Thank you. First, I want to register my disappointment. I had my hand up for 10 minutes.
I think you'll be here.
I also wanted to point out, just quickly following up on Representative Bence's comments, we are losing resource industry jobs, but look at the bright side. We have a huge seasonal impact in the employment market from all the firefighters we gain in the summer.
Yeah.
I also I really have two questions, and I'll state them because I think they're pretty discreet. But if I confuse you or anything, let me know. The first is on the capital gains revenue issue, which does seem like a real forecasting problem, which becomes a budgetary problem, of course, for the state. Has anyone, or is there any research or data about the impact of large tax events moving out of state? In other words, someone who anticipates a large capital gain in any given year, relocating to a lower tax state, say Washington, for example, which I think has no capital gains. That's the first question. The second question is to follow up on Senator Rosenbaum's inquiry about the character of the jobs that are being created. Do you look at, I guess, wage growth as a measure of the kinds and quality of jobs and another indication of demand besides the unemployment rate?
Yeah, Representative Conger, in terms of the capital gains study, there are some out there. I'd like to wait a month or two for the full answer. The bubble chart with all the domestic migration is flowed out of work that I'm doing to present at the Oregon Economic Forum on October 20th. The main part of that presentation is a migration model describing the influences that determine why people move to and from Oregon. So hopefully there'll be some work, there'll be something valuable there. Anecdotally, there's always been a lot of folks moving up to Washington for tax purposes. Is that going to change as the baby boomers get ready to sell their lifelong businesses is sort of what I want to get a hold of. In terms of the job quality, you point out that wage growth isn't coming back, and I apologize that I was remiss in answering Senator Rosenbaum's question in terms of that when I was saying there's still evidence of slack in the labor market. Well, that's the number one thing people point to, is that we're not getting a lot of wage growth yet. When workers become relatively scarce, firms have to compete for them, and they bid up wages. We're still, for the most part, we're still waiting. In terms of job quality, the best place to look is in the occupational data. I point you to some of the job polarization work that my colleague Josh has done. The best, rather than looking at industries, we can look at occupations, which would be, you know, doctors, or it was an occupation, or a construction worker, or a drill press operator, or the like. And so we can assign these to, you know, different wage groups and take a look at our performance. And so far in our recovery, our performance has been split, where we're seeing a lot of growth at both the high-end and low-end occupations, and really very little in the middle. Some of that is not to be unexpected, given the nature of this recession. A lot of our construction workers and local government workers, the teachers and the like, are right in that middle group.
Representative Conger, follow-up?
No, I think that covered it well. I guess not a question, but just hopefully in looking at out-migration and the reasons, I assume that estate tax and capital gains tax would have similar implications given the demographics that you were talking about, Mark. And thank you for answering the question. I thought that was a great presentation by both you and Josh. Well done.
Thank you. I think Representative Conger speaks for me as well. It's a great presentation. We appreciate it. I especially appreciate the clarity with which you present data. Understanding what the denominators are on each slide is critical in order to understand what you're telling us, and I'm especially appreciative of the fact that you hammered on that issue throughout the presentation. Anything else for these two? Thank you very much. With that, the committee is going to take a recess for about 15 minutes. We'll try to come back about 5 minutes to 10. And with that, we're in recess.
And the Senate's in recess. We will bring the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee out of recess.
The Revenue Committee will come back to order, and we'll continue with our agenda, which is the overview of the tax credit scheduled for sunset in 2016 from the Legislative Revenue Office. And we'll start with Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have one introduction. We have Emily Brixey here, so our new intern from Willamette. This is her first day.
Welcome, Emily.
And She is going to actually work with us in the tax credit program, our tax credit review program. And we also have Jenna Borgeld, who is another Willamette intern, who is also working with us. So we've got a couple of smart young people to help us as we review the tax credits. Chris is going to go through kind of an introduction with you about where we are in terms of the tax credit process and emphasize the credits that are sunsetting. I just wanted to remind you of House Bill 2002, which you approved in the 2013 session. And what that does is directs the Legislative Revenue Officer to submit a report addressing each income or excise tax credit that is scheduled to expire during the next even-numbered year. So this is the beginning of that process, and we'll have a report, a formal report for you at the beginning of the regular session. It does say that it directs us to include those that are sunsetting, but it also says that that the report may include information related to other tax credits at the direction of an interim committee related to revenue. So that's you, an interim committee related to revenue. So if there are thoughts you have on that, please let us know or work through the chairs on some additional things you think might be in that report.
Bravo.
Okay.
Chris.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committees. As Paul said, this is an initial outline of the report that we're putting together with respect to, in response to House Bill 2002. And what we're hoping to get back is we'll throw this out there and get feedback on the structure of the report. Even today, we've had a lot of discussions about exactly how the report would look. And the outline that you have before you is probably already the third or so iteration of exactly what the report would look like. So it is very much a work in progress. So this is just kind of a checking in as to where we are currently. And so right now, the report is broken down into four sections. We have an introduction, which just kind of sets up the report. It'll talk a little bit about the history of tax expenditure analysis in the state, kind of starting with 1995 legislation that required the creation of the tax expenditure report, and then moving into 2009 with House Bill 2067, which put sunset dates on all the tax credits, and then into 2013, which is the House Bill 2002. The second section of the report right now, we're thinking, is just kind of background for all income tax expenditures. It's basically laying out the landscape and providing context for the focused analysis on tax credits. And in here, income tax expenditures, as the committees both are aware, can be broken down into two categories. We have those that are in federal law and those that are in Oregon law. And the federal law, we tie to those through our federal connection. So any policy discussion around those invariably pulls in the whole discussion about federal connect. So right off the bat, there is some policy discussion difference. In terms of revenue impact from the 2013-2015 tax expenditure report, about 70% of the revenue impact is due to federal tax expenditures and 30% is due to Oregon tax expenditures. And within those federal tax expenditures, about 50% are federal exclusions. In each one of these categories, there are different nuances that would affect any policy discussions. For example, federal exclusions are items that are not reported on the tax return. So, for example, a lot of policy discussions come up about controlling the cost of tax expenditures and, say, for example, shave all of them by some percentage to reduce their cost. And that works for items that are reported on the tax returns, but the exclusions are not on the return. So to follow through on that policy would involve an additional reporting requirement. Not that that can't happen, it's just another piece of the discussion. Then the adjustments and deductions make up about 20% of that other piece. And most of those deductions are Schedule A deductions, which in 2013 there was a lot of discussion about home mortgage interest, property tax deductions, and charitable contributions. And then the 30% or so for Oregon, about 15% are subtractions, 13% are credits, and 1% is other, and most of that other is the single sales factor. So again, that the whole point of this section is just context. Then the third section of the report, we'd move into the tax credit review process, a discussion of that. And right now we're thinking this will just summarize broadly the process that was followed to some extent, to differing extents, in 2011 and 2013, where there was interim work
to focus on which tax credits would be included in that, and they would start off with those that are sunsetting, but could include other policies. For example, if a tax credit involved a significant amount of lead time and investment, then it might be necessary to include that a session or so before the sunset if there's a lot of lead time required. And then as we would move into this session, and this, of course, every session depends on the direction leadership would like to take, would be a distribution to the policy committees to discuss the policies of the tax credits themselves. What are they intended to achieve? How good are they achieving those policies? And then the third step would be the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. And in the past, the discussion here, as the committees are aware, or at least the folks who have been around a couple of sessions are aware, is almost a ways and means like process where one model is a tax credit budget, and the policy committees would forward to the Joint Tax Credit Committee the policies they would like to see enacted, and there would be a revenue impact associated with each of those policies, and then the JTAX committee could work through that. That is just one possible avenue to take. And so this section would be basically a review, not necessarily recommending a particular approach. But the table that I've included here is analogous to the budget side, and each of these program areas are provided in the tax expenditure report. And again, for context, all of the income tax expenditures, the total there is about $12.5 billion in income tax expenditures. Wow. And for all tax credits, it's $1.6 billion. And then for the sunsetting tax credits in the upcoming biennium, the current estimate for 13-15 was about $138 million. Also working on some tables to provide more information on exactly the breakdown of where the big ones are and so forth. For example, of that $12.5 billion, half of that is federal exclusions. Then section four is the meat of the report, so to speak. And here we're trying to come up with a structure that can just be applied to every tax credit. So people are familiar with how to, there's a uniform way to digest the information that's included in the report. And to that end, we're trying to take the 20 or so tax credits and lump them into similar policy categories. And so this also is in flux, but right now we have basically five categories plus another category, where we have healthcare incentives is the first category. So we have the rural medical credit, cost in lieu of nursing home care, long-term care insurance, Oregon Life and Health IGA assessments, and then some TRICARE and some veterans incentives. So the idea here is, again, kind of following on the policy committee approach, these are all related in one way or another to healthcare, then that might be the way that leadership would like to go. This kind of approach, while we're setting things up here in one way, they could certainly come out in there are different ways to categorize these things. For example, a couple of these healthcare also are related to military and veterans issues. So that could be another approach to take. It depends on kind of the budget perspective. The second group there, the child care incentives. We have the child independent care credit, which is we're tied to a federal credit. And then we have a working family child care credit. And then employer provided dependent care assistance and child care division contributions. These are all toward the notion of helping to helping families pay for childcare. And some of these are direct overlap a great deal. For example, the child independent care and the working family child care credit, there's a lot of overlap between those two. So one possibility for you during the session is to combine those somehow or modify them so that there's only one tax credit as opposed to two. And just really to discuss the best way to help fund child care through the tax system. That's why they're grouped together. And the next one, this is a clear sign that this is a work in progress document. I have that labeled disability related incentives. Incentive isn't really a good word for there, hence the word choice. But here we have disabled child, elderly or permanently disabled, and then loss of limbs and severe disability. These are all for the most part, those are personal exempt. There are additional personal exemption credits that are given for these disabilities. And then we get into some business investment incentives. And this group kind of sets out a little bit different from the nature of most of the tax credits this session, which are family-oriented. Here we have the Qualified Low-Income Community Investment, or the New Markets Tax Credit. And then we have the Public University Venture Development Fund. Those are the only two that are related to business investment this time around. And then something we've labeled financial independence, and these are the IDA contributions and withdrawals in terms of helping people gain financial independence. And the last category, the other incentives, is these transportation projects. And for those who were here in 2011, we'll remember this was part of the Betsy discussion. And at the time, the committee and the legislature was pretty clear that they wanted to end the subsidy for the transit services. And so one piece of what currently exists as transportation projects are these bus passes. And at the time, the legislature wanted to end it. They just didn't want to end it immediately, so they phased it out over time. And by 2016, it's completely phased out. So that one.
That's not what the chart shows.
Madam Chair, as related to the bus project, and some of these data do need to be updated. These are active. Some of these numbers are old. The building up of that is related to the five-year structure of the Betsy, and so of the old Betsy. So
okay,
over a couple of years.
This is the tail.
This is part of the tail. Yes, and I do need to say these are old numbers. Some of them, and the numbers here are the current law impacts. So the $138 million in 13-15, and then the about $100 million in 15-17. If all of these tax credits were allowed to sunset, this is an estimate of the cost to the revenue system over the 3 years. Other information that I've provided is the cost of extending the sunsets, and I think that's a table that's pretty familiar to folks. And that is, roughly speaking, the difference between the 13-15 number and the 15-17 number. So if all tax credits were just allowed to sunset and none of these were taken up and none of them were extended, the cost of the revenue system in 13-15, about $140 million, then that falls to $100 million in 15-17, and then it falls to $42 million in 17-19. And it's a declining over time, and that'll just be the tail and carry forwards of the tax credits. The cost of extending the tax credits, which is another table that I think folks have become accustomed to, is the cost to the revenue system of extending the sunset dates. And so that would be, if all of these sunset dates were extended 6 years, then the cost in 15-17 would be about $60 million. And I don't have that on the table here, but it's kind of the inverse arithmetic.
But Mr. Chair, but yes, that would please. Be in addition to the $96 million.
Right. That's correct. Okay. Using very rough math.
This is what we're actually spending under current law.
Current estimates for under current
law. Under current law. Extension would increase the number. And the other table you've given us in the past is the net between the two.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So when I said to Representative Nose earlier today that for this coming set of things, we're looking at around $60 million for the first biennium, that is the net number if we were to extend the sunset.
Right. Okay. Correct.
Thank you. Senator Hess, please.
Thank you. On our the law that allowed us to do this, I assume would have to be changed or amended if we wanted to include deductions to this process.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator, the law that passed, the sunset dates only pertain to tax credits, and deductions could be included. that's at the discretion of the committee.
If I could follow up.
Please, Chair. Yes.
I think that's a worthy discussion because that is where, and I think most deductions are probably worthwhile, but I do think it would be a more efficient process if we subjected them to the same kind of scrutiny that tax credits are now under.
It is on the list, Senator, and I do appreciate your support.
Okay, so that's just a summary table. Now, the ABCD here is part of this, again, the kind of the meat and the analysis that will be put into the report about each tax credit. And this structure, we're thinking right now, the report will read, this outline will be repeated for every tax credit. So in a sense, each tax credit will be its own chapter, if you will, or each group of similar, and just to facilitate kind of an ease of use of document. And this has received a lot of moving around, so it's in flux. So any input you'd have on readability or usefulness would be much appreciated. The starting is really just a simple description and historical revenue impact of the tax credit. You know, under current law, how does it work? What is it? And the historical revenue impact. Then the next section, B, is all about the policy goals. What is the public policy purpose? We will try to ascertain what that is. A lot of times it's not in current law. As those who have read the tax expenditure report, a common phrase in there is presumably the incentive is to fill in the blank. I'm not sure to what extent we'll be able to improve on that. There's been a lot of work gone into historical tax expenditure reports, but that is what it is, and it's very key to evaluating any tax expenditure is clarity on what is it supposed to do.
Well, at least you can get the two committees' opinion about what they think the purpose of the tax expenditure is, rather than having someone in the department making a guess.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad you volunteered to do that.
No, I think that at least in the House committee, we've worked pretty hard to try to have that conversation so that when you prepare them, you've at least had the input from the committee.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And we will be filling these out and presenting it to the committee to make sure we are on track with where the committees are thinking. And that is an important starting point. And then the next three items, and all of these items are spelled out to one extent or another in House Bill 2002. That's where these all came from, was we're trying to incorporate every piece of 2002. So along with what the policy purpose is, there'd be a discussion about the timeline to achieve the goal and whether or not that makes sense, and then how to measure the progress. And to the extent we can measure that progress, we'll include that information. And then lastly, is the credit an effective and efficient way to achieve the goal? We'll have that analysis if this is the best way to do that. The next section is background and related incentives. Here we're thinking an actual legislative history since the creation of each tax credit and changes over time. And then any similar policies or subsidies in Oregon or other states or at the federal level to find out what other states are doing. That's a very common question. Somebody comes with an idea of a tax credit or a tax incentive to the committees, then a very common question is, well, what do other states do and what have they found? So this will be the place in the report where we're trying to incorporate as much of that information as possible. And there's some logistical challenges about just presenting that information in a clear way and balancing the main gist and the main approach other states take without getting bogged down in every nuance and in every detail. Otherwise, the document can be quite lengthy, and then it starts to defeat itself in terms of usability. And then the last piece is currently labeled impact analysis, and this is where we'll discuss the direct and indirect beneficiaries of a tax credit and the policy and any intended targets and evidence that we have about that impact. And a good example of kind of the direct and indirect beneficiaries of the tax credit itself versus the policy will be individual development account contributions. This is a program where taxpayers can make a contribution to this credit and receive up to a 75% tax credit. The money goes into a fund, if you will, that then gets used for lower income people to gain financial independence. So the beneficiaries of the tax credit tend to be wealthier individuals who make these contributions. But the beneficiaries of the tax policy are lower-income folks who are trying to gain financial independence. So not always is it the case that the beneficiary of the tax credit is the same as the beneficiary of the tax credit policy. Another one might be rural medical providers, where the tax credit goes to the medical providers who provide those services in rural areas, they're kind of the direct beneficiary of the tax credit, some of the arguably direct or indirect beneficiaries of the policies will be the citizens of these rural areas who now have access to medical care. And trying to distinguish between the direct and all of those pieces. And if there is an intended target spelled out in statute about exactly who this credit or policy is intended to benefit, and then whatever evidence we can find on the success of those. We'll also incorporate the administrative costs for the state and the taxpayer. A lot of times tax credits don't have much. They kind of have a marginal administrative cost. It's just a line on a tax return. Then the cost may just be to DOR with respect to tax compliance. But other administrative costs could occur if a tax credit requires some sort of certification. And so that's a cost to the state. And then cost to the taxpayer, too, about whatever documents they have to maintain upon audit or if they have to provide that at the time of filing. The issue of a direct appropriation as opposed to a tax credit would be incorporated. And then some analysis of what would happen if it were allowed to expire, as well as potential incremental changes in the tax credit. One of the issues we've talked about internally is how much detail to include about possible alternatives to a tax credit. In many respects, those are, you know, infinite is a bit of an overstatement, but there can be a lot of different ways to change a tax credit. So one of the things we're trying to be careful about is presenting something in such a way that it indicates that that just by simple inclusion in report suggests that it's the best way to change it. We're trying to figure that out. That's really kind of an open-ended situation. And we've had advocates come talk to us about ways that they'd like to change certain incentives. And I'm sure you will be hearing from some of those advocates if you haven't already. Mm-hmm. And then the last piece will be including other states if available. And that's really trying to look at, it's just a broader approach of whatever evidence exists to the effectiveness of these tax credits or the impact of the tax credits. To the extent other states have conducted some analysis, we're happy to steal from that analysis and incorporate it into this report to provide more information about the impact. And that was probably a little quick, but that's just an outline for you to digest and any input you have on.
Questions, comments? Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the impact analysis, where you talk about the direct and indirect beneficiaries, will you be including income level of the people who benefit? You know, like we always did with the senior medical deduction, we could really parse out what the income level was of the people who are benefiting. Will you be doing that same kind of analysis? I'm thinking of some in particular, like the long-term care insurance.
Yes, Madam Chair. We will, and I know the Department of Revenue puts out some information as they're going through. They're updating the tax expenditure report, and they put out some information on distributional analysis. We may be incorporating that, or we may be doing it differently. I'm not really sure, but we will have that information from the tax returns, and that's important to see, and we have that, and we can do it by income group, and we're trying to figure out if we do it by quintile or percentile or by dollar income amount, but there will be some distributional analysis included in there.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Others? I'm wondering if you're planning to include the tax effect of these of the transactions that under D1 related to federal taxation or taxation from other states. Mm-hmm. I mean, what triggered me thinking about that was the 75% tax credit that you described. It makes a big difference what the incentive is for a wealthy individual to make that kind of contribution, depending upon what the federal tax treatment of that transaction is. I think it would be useful to include that federal tax treatment of those kinds of transactions. For example, one of the things we've learned lately is that when we sell a tax credit like the film and video tax credit, because some accountants have taken the position that the federal tax implication of that is that it's deductible as a charitable contribution, the effect is a reduction of taxes of more than 100% of the tax credit. And therefore, some people are willing to pay more than the tax credit actually gains them in Oregon because of the federal tax deduction. I think it would be really useful to know what the federal tax implications are, if any, of these kinds of transactions as part of your impact analysis.
And Mr. Chair, that could be, we will certainly look at that and include where we can. That might be, just thinking off the top of my head, that might be a different section and might not be in each tax credit because it could be right. The same. It doesn't matter which specific tax credit it is, but it is right. The interaction with federal law. So that would be perhaps another section in the report or included elsewhere. But that, those are the kinds of things we would look at.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick,
I heartily agree with Mr. Chair on this. I wish we'd had that kind of analysis when we were struggling with the Betsy issue, because if we can quantify what the federal benefit is, we're in a much better position to set the level of the tax, to set the level of the incentive.
Right.
And it also helps us address the but-for issue, because there are some federal tax credits that are so rich that we don't need. I think probably the electric car is a perfect example of one of those. And so to know, and I know I'm striking close to your heart, Mr. Chair.
Well, I've been lobbied a bunch on that issue. That's the reason I'm chuckling.
Yes.
With people who disagree with that point.
Yes, yeah. And I'm sure people disagree with me a lot on a lot of these points. Yeah. But it does help us to understand, you know, where we set, if we are going to do an incentive, where we set it to get the best possible deal for the taxpayer.
Yeah.
And, Madam Chair, to that point, the but-for question is important in many of the tax expenditures, it's not I don't know that it's universally applicable. For example, the disability-related. That's why I cringe at the word incentive. I need to figure out a different word for that.
In those cases, we're simply trying to cut taxes for people with those kind of disabilities.
Right.
And there's no point in pretending that there's some kind of an incentive involved in it, because there isn't.
Correct.
Yeah.
And there are probably shades in between, but.
Good point.
Right. No, but I think that you get the sense of what we're talking about.
Yes.
If you're giving a tax credit involving one of these medical healthcare incentives, the federal tax implications are quite different than they are for someone who's contributing to that fund you were describing, the Financial Independence Incentives Fund. If the federal government gives a tax deduction for a contribution to that fund, and we give a 75% credit, depending upon the tax bracket the person's in, they may get more than 100% of their money back in reduced taxes.
Right.
I think it's useful to know that if it's true.
Right.
Anything else? Appreciate the report. It's a great primer for a new member, and it's a great reminder for the rest of us. Thank you very much.
Is it coming out?
Is there anything else on this topic?
No, Mr. Chair. Then we're going to turn to our last.
I'm sorry.
I must have missed this part. I'm sorry.
Please, no. Go ahead.
When's the report actually going to come out?
Representative Nose, the report is due, I think, on or before February 1st. So it'll come out right at the beginning of the 15th session.
Right on. I'm sure it'll be well read.
All right. And among the things that we will do is that we will have in the hopper bills that extend these tax credits, but they're built in such a way that they're imminently amendable or defeatable or passable or whatever. I mean, so we haven't given away any options at that point. Yeah. Okay, so shall we move on then to update on the phase out of the business energy tax credit? Legislative Revenue Office. Is that you again, Chris?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Don't look so happy.
I'm not sure which straw I drew.
Well, the short one, obviously.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committees, most of this is not new information to members who have been around for a while, it might be new information to newer members. So what I have here is a brief summary of the history presented in apparently red and blue charts. about the Betsy, and that kind of sets up the discussion for the Department of Energy, who's going to talk about their efforts to wind down the tax program. So I'm just going to, through a series of charts, provide that walkthrough of the history of the past 7 years, acknowledging that the program was created in 1979, so it's been around for 35 years, or had been around. The first chart here gets back to 2007 and the expansion that was discussed at that time in terms of increasing the incentives for renewable projects. At the time, there were three categories of projects. There were conservation projects, recycling projects, and renewable energy projects. And the first chart is what we thought the cost of the program was during the discussions in 2007. And those are those blue bars. And these numbers come from the tax expenditure report and the forecast from them for the 09 and 13, 11, 13 biennia. The red bar is what we thought the incremental impact would be in the 2007 session. In percentage term, that presents in 09-11 a 44% growth in the program, and in 11-13 a 59% growth in the program. So those were, at the time, expected large percentage growths in the program, again, focusing on the renewables project for the most part.
Oh, could I interrupt
you? Yeah.
I think you said it backwards. The red bar is what was actual, and the blue bar is what was predicted. That's correct?
Madam Chair, that's the second chart.
Okay.
In the first chart, so we're in the 07 session, and the legislature is trying to understand the impact of these policies. And from the tax expenditure report, the blue bars are the history of what we thought the cost of the program was. Mm-hmm. And at the time in the tax expenditure report, there was an 07-09 projection and an 09-11 projection. There was not an 11-13 projection, so I just grew that forward at a growth rate. And the red bar, that was basically the revenue impact on the bills that expanded the program. So that's what we thought. That's what we thought at the time. And even at the time, in 09-11, that represented a 44% growth in the cost of the program, and then in 11-13, a 59% growth in the program. That's the first chart. So that's what we thought. And then after 07, when we started getting much debt, and I'll touch base on this.
Wow.
Well, actually, to set that up, again, for context for everybody, in 2007, the information that we had available to us was a history of pre-certification data from the Department of Energy, and they had that up through 2006. So during the 07 session, we would have had up through 2006 pre-cert data, and the 2006 may have been preliminary, is still in some state at that point. Because a lot of projects would get a pre-cert and then something would happen, there would be an attrition and they would never become finaled. In terms of tax revenue, at the time in 2007, on personal income tax returns, the most recent information we had was 2004 tax returns. And on the corporate side, it was 2003 tax returns. So here we are in 2007. What information do we have available to us? Well, we have pre-cert data up through 2006, and we can see the growth rate in that, and we're not sure what the attrition, we know there's some sort of attrition rate associated with those. And we have personal income tax return data through 2004 and corporate data through 2003. And then to add on to that, in the personal income tax return, in 2004, tax credits were not separately identified. There was a large category of other credits. And so the work that went into the tax expenditure report, there was a triangulation of data and trying to figure out which tax credit. We knew the total of other credits, but we didn't know any of the pieces. So right off the bat, not the best information possible. And a key point there is a connection between the pre-certification to final certification process and the tax returns. I don't know that we had a clear understanding of the connection of those two and that whole process. But be that as it may, those were the estimates we had in that first chart. Now, after the law passed and we started getting a better understanding of the certification data and how that flow worked from pre-cert to final cert, and started getting better data on tax returns, better data in terms of more timely in terms of 05 and 06 as the years turned to 2008 and 2009, and another piece of very helpful information. In 2005, the Department of Revenue was able to change their tax returns, the personal income tax returns, so that tax credits could be individually identified. So 2005 was the first time that we could look at individual tax returns and see this is how much was Betsy and how much was each of those other credits. And as we can see here now, to your point, Madam Chair, the blue is taken from that first chart, kind of the new and the expansion, and the red is what the actuals were going back. And a key piece there is, for example, in 2005, while in 07 we thought the cost of the program was about $20 million, in actuality it was about $80 million. Now, a big piece of that, again, there are a lot of nuances here, and I could have provided a lot more charts, but I didn't want to torture people. Again, the program was conservation, recycling, and renewables. So while the program itself we thought was 20, it was 80, a lot of that were conservation projects that were not part of the policy change, except there was a small piece of energy related to conservation, but most of it was about renewables. So a key point here, it's a perennial issue in terms of making policy changes, as well as the forecast that you just heard, how well do we understand where we are right now? And there will always be data limitations with respect to tax returns, because there's just the tax system has, there's a delay in terms of giving people and businesses time to file a return and so forth. The next chart here focuses on the renewable projects and takes a stab at assigning the revenue impact to each of the changes that were implemented in 2007. The blue bar represents just the regular 35% tax credit. Prior to 2007, the tax credit equaled 35% of the project costs. And so that blue bar represents what the cost of that tax credit would have been if the 35% were maintained. Now, what is not included in this is the but-for question. So don't really know how many of these projects would not have been undertaken if it had stayed at 35%. I didn't try to incorporate this. This is just taking a look at all the projects that did happen and how much were due to that base 35% tax credit. And depending on the order that I calculate these, you can get numbers that are a little bit different, but then from those, I looked at the 50% differential. So the red bar represents the additional 15% cost of the credit, going from a 35% credit to a 50% credit. And then the green is the increased cap going up to the $20 million in project costs. So going from what would be a $5 million credit to a $10 million credit. And then the purple are the manufacturing tax credits. The renewable manufacturing, the solar panels, and so forth. And so that's just a look at kind of that piece. We've gotten a lot of questions about how much of the revenue impact was due to each of those policy changes. And this is one particular answer. Depending on the approach taken, the numbers can vary a little bit different, can vary a little bit. The next two charts just show the history of the program for the pre-certs and the final certs. And you can see how, relatively speaking, stable the program was throughout the 80s and the 90s. And then once we hit 2000 and beyond, it started to grow, and it was growing in 05 and 06, and then, as everybody knows, really took off in 08 and 09. And that light blue are the large renewables, which is where the big revenue impact was. Again, I'm pretty sure that's not a headline statement right now at this point.
Mostly wind, isn't it?
Yeah. Correct.
Okay.
And here it just goes through 2011. That's when the program was ended for the pre-certs.
Mr. Chair, please, if I can just enter, that's why I was asking for the federal information, because if you look at that renewable spike there, that was at the same time that the federal government put in an incredibly rich tax credit, and they did other things besides just a straight tax credit. And so, you know, if we had fully focused on that, we would have said, maybe we should have cut the 35% instead of increasing it, because the activity we were trying to encourage would have occurred most likely anyway because of the federal. And in my research after the fact, that did indeed turn out to be the case. So we were vastly over-subsidizing during that period because of the federal.
And just for some context, over from 1980 to 2011, about $1.7 billion in pre-cert credits were the total. A third of that, about $560 million, were from 1980 to 2006. And then two-thirds of that were from 07 to 11 in terms of totaling up the numbers of those bars. And then the final cert, similar graph here. I do have a few final certs in 15 and 16. As I think Energy may mention, when the program wound down, a number of taxpayers that had earned the tax credit were looking for pass-through partners. They were unable to find them by the time the program ended. So final certifications were awarded to these taxpayers, but they have 2 years to look for somebody to sell the tax credit to. So to just incorporate that piece, there's a small tail there in 15 and 16, and that's why that's there, as opposed to the hard deadline in 2014. And similar to the pre-certs, about $1.4 billion were final certed between over the time frame, and 26% of that was prior to 06, and then 74% were after that. And the next chart here, we've also gotten a lot of questions about final certification tax credits since 2007. Since that time, about just over $1 billion in tax credits were certified. About 70% of that pertained to programs that were affected by the 07 legislation. The two pieces of that table there, we have the conservation at 35% and recycling. That's about $300 million of that $1 billion. Those were not changed by the 07 expansion. Those programs were maintained. The other pieces there are the conservation. Some projects at conservation got 50%, and then the renewables and the renewable manufacturing. And the renewable 35%, that was just a tail of those projects that became final certed in 07. And then the renewables are three categories there, again, broken out by size. And then the last chart I wanted to show kind of gets at where we are now and what we continue to pay attention to in terms of the tail of the tax credit. The red bar represents the amount claimed on tax returns, and I mean the red line, and then the green line is the amount that is actually used to reduce tax liability. And the difference between
my question.
And the difference between those two are carry forwards. So, for example, and that blue line there is 2011, the most recent year for which we have both personal and corporate tax return information. So in 2011, about $170 million were claimed on tax returns, but only about $83 million were actually used to reduce liability. So
let me ask you this. When it's claimed on a tax return, Mr. Chair.
Please, yes.
When it's claimed on a tax return, that doesn't mean that they're reducing their tax liability necessarily that year. They just have to keep claiming it until they can reduce their liability?
Madam Chair, that's correct. They're taxpayers are supposed to put the full amount of credits that they can claim on the tax return. I'm pretty sure that they don't all do that. So there is some fuzziness to the numbers. They're supposed to write that. If they are allowed to claim $30 million in Betsy credits, they write that $30 million. And if their gross liability is, say, $10 million, then they will only, and if that's the only credit they claimed, then they will only use $10 million of that tax credit. And then the other $20 million could be carried forward to the next year.
So then they have to list it again the
Correct.
Next year, and they can do that for up to 5 years?
The carry forward is 8 years.
8 years.
And that's why the red bar get so high is because there's a lot of double counting in this red line, in that they could be carried forward 1 year and they'll show up again the next year and then the third year until either they get used or they run out of carry forwards, and then the program is completely phased out in terms of a revenue impact.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to deduplicate this?
I'm sorry?
Is it possible to deduplicate it? so that you only get, you only count the tax credit claimed once?
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, we don't have the detailed data.
Can't do that. Okay.
I do know at the Department of Revenue, not to bring in an unrelated topic, but with the systems replacement at DOR, one of the things that they're are trying to work with the vendor is better information on the carry forwards. Because right now on tax returns, we have two numbers, a claimed, actually it's just a claimed, and then we have bottom liability. Now there's no order in which, in tax law, there's no order in which you take tax credit A or B or C. So a lot of this information, when we have a taxpayer who claimed, say, three credits for a total of $30 million, and their pre-credit, their gross tax liability is $10 million, we know that they only used $10 million, but we don't necessarily know which credit it was. Presumably, their accountants are keeping track of it, and they're using the oldest credits first, but we don't have that level of detail.
Mr. Chair, so basically, by my math, we should see some level of credits running out of carry forward as early as 2017, 2016 for the very earliest ones?
Madam Chair, that could be, yes. And there could be, on any given year, there can be credits that are just gone because, so we're in 2013, a tax credit, because the program's been around a while, a taxpayer could have earned a credit in 2004 mm-hmm. and they took it themselves, they didn't sell it. And they could run out, they could be up, their 8 years could be up by now. Or
so
maybe my math isn't
do
quite
we
right.
keep track of that? Because I'm trying to get a sense of what the actual tail is on this. Do we keep track of the expiring carry forwards?
Madam Chair, we keep trying to. we have the Department of Energy has provided a lot of information to the Department of Revenue. And we've tried to link up these systems, and we keep running into problems of having a clean information about taxpayer A, and these are all the credits that they are allowed to claim, and then this is their tax return and when they've claimed them. So we keep banging our head against that wall with not much success. So in lieu of that, we have this gross aspect where we can look at the tax returns and how much in total was claimed, and then how much was used. And this is all linked to certification data. The model that I have set up, the Department of Energy has provided me a great deal of information. And so I can look at the mapping of when the tax credits got their final certification, so when they should be showing up in the tax system. So if a tax credit were finaled in 2008, then I know the 5 years that they would claim it would be 08 through 12.
But you said 5 years? I thought it was eight.
Well, the initial credit is 5 years, and then there's an 8-year carry forward.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's right.
So, structurally, there's a very long tail.
But you're predicting here that it's mostly gone by 2025.
Mostly, that's okay. That's where I currently am with the numbers. This is something that I pull out every quarter, and you know we communicate with the Office of Economic Analysis for the forecast because they want to know the cost of the credits and update it with additional information. So right now, 2011 is the most recent year we have complete information. For 2012, we have personal income tax credit information, but we do not have corporate yet. And so right now, we seem to be at a peak of the tax credits, of the Betsy credits in tax year 13 and 14. And each of these last year and this year, maybe just under $120 million. So that feeds into the shape of the tail that I think we're going to hit. But every time we get a piece of new information, that will affect what we think has happened down there, as well as the forecast. If we hit another recession, then the ability to use the tax credits gets dampened. So all of this is tied to the current law forecast.
Okay. Representative Jones?
So am I remembering correctly from just following along in the newspaper and the media that we did sort of fix this, but it sounds like in the process, basically what we've done is we prevented anything further, but people that still have the ability to use this, they're going to continue to get it. So it's still a very rich tax credit that's out there that we're going to continue to have.
I think that's an accurate statement. When we realized the executive branch and we ourselves had misestimated the cost of this credit, we passed a bill in 2009 to fix it. The governor vetoed that bill for reasons I never completely understood. We passed another one in 2010, which was pretty close to the one we passed in 2009 that he assigned. And we have been working on adjustments ever since. We thought last year or the year before that we were finished with that. Part of the reason for the report today is to figure out whether that's really true or not.
It sounds like we're not, right? If I'm following this correctly, that we may have prevented anything further, but we're going to have to live with whatever we for a period of time.
Well, and for the next half an hour, we're going to hear a little more from the department about where we are on other aspects of the same problem.
Mr. Chair,
yes, please.
Further clarify that. We always knew there was going to be a tail. And what we did was we basically stopped the hemorrhage, but it's still going to continue to haunt us for a number of years. And my hope is that some of the credits will end up not being used to reduce the impact on our general fund.
Yeah. And let me clarify, when I said the governor vetoed the bill, we're not talking about the current governor. It's the one before that.
To try and get at that point, in this chart, in 2009, the final certification tax credits were about $140 million. When those get certified in 2009, the core structure of the credit was that $140 million would be claimed over 5 years, from 09 through 13, spread out over those 5 years, and then with an eight-year carry forward. And as these final certs, they kind of stacked up over time, and there just wasn't enough tax liability in the system to use them quickly, if that's the right term. Because in 2009, while 140 million were final certified, about 75 million were actually used to reduce liability that year. But a lot of that 75 million were due to credits that were received final certification in prior years.
Yeah, please.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm not understanding something, so I'd like to ask one more question.
Please.
Can you explain that you said there's a five-year credit, but then you have eight-year carryover, and that's confusing me. It makes it sound like it's a 12-year deal, or I'm unclear about what that means.
The Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, take a 50% credit, and that is worth $50 million.
Okay.
Just to try and make the math simple off the top
of
my head.
That's fine.
So the final certification is awarded, and somebody gets a $5 million credit.
All right.
For each of the next 5 years, they are allowed to take $1 million of that $5 million.
Okay. All right.
So in that first year, they will claim $1 million. And if their gross tax, their pre-credit liability, is only $500,000, they will, say $75,000 to get away from all the fives. They will use $750,000 of that, and they will carry forward $250,000 to year two. So now in year two,
they have $1.25 million.
$1.25 million.
And then they only had $7,500 that year, so then they're carrying over $1.5 million. And then we get to the 5 year thing, but we haven't used it all. And then so then I have another 8 years to try to.
Correct.
Wow.
And in year two, presumably, what they would use first would be the $250,000. They won't even touch the $1 million.
Wow. Okay.
Welcome to the Oregon Legislature.
I'm glad I didn't vote on that bill. Sorry.
Most of us here did.
Thank you, Representative.
No offense to my esteemed colleagues.
So the last point I wanted to make is the difference between the red and the green. In 2008, it was $17 million. By 2012, it was $90 million. That's this carry-forward bundle that we have. And pretty soon, I don't have it right in front of me, within the next couple of years, the carry-forward amount will be larger than the base amount, if you will.
Right. The 8 years get bigger than the 5 years is.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Chris? Of course, we can call him back anytime we want to, but I'd sure like to get on to the department. Thank you. We'll hear from the department.
Good Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Kaplan, Acting Director of the Oregon Department of Energy and fellow short straw drawer. I'm joined by Anthony Buckley, Division Administrator for Energy Development Services, the division that oversees the BETSI program at the Department of Energy. After 35 years, the Business Energy Tax Credit Program concluded on July 1st, 2014. As of June 30th, 2014, 24,695 business energy tax credits, equaling an investment of approximately $1.2 billion, had been issued for projects in Oregon that leveraged nearly $6 billion in investment. Despite its troublesome recent history, the program provided incentives that helped thousands of businesses, schools, nonprofits, and tribal governments save money and create energy. The BETSI supported the development and use of alternative modes of transportation, which lowered energy costs and reduced emissions. Nevertheless, the benefits of BETSI have largely been overshadowed by its recent problems. We're testifying today to provide an overview of how we managed the last year of BETSI's life, to provide a critical assessment of the program, and to discuss some of what we could have done better administering the program. Over the life of the BETSI program, it was modified a number of times. In 1985, it was changed to allow investor-owned utilities to assume tax credits for rental housing properties for a cash payment incentive to the rental housing owners. In 1986, 387 BETSIs were issued. In 1989, the BETSI was expanded to cover commercial and industrial projects, a segment of the market that we felt needed encouragement to invest in energy conservation projects. In 1999, the $40 million cap on the amount of tax credits issued per year was eliminated. Individual tax credits awards also increased from $2 million to $10 million. In 2001, another expansion occurred that allowed nonprofits, government entities, schools, tribes, and others without a state tax liability to qualify and sell their BETSIs to other entities through a mechanism called pass-through. In 2002, 700 BETSIs were issued. In 2007, the business energy tax credit for renewable energy systems increased from 35 to 50%, and the project cost limit increased from $10 million to $20 million. The following year, 2,264 BETSIs were issued. We are, as a state, among the national leaders on energy policy and implementation. These collective BETSI strategies created incentives that contributed to a significant development of our energy system. The list of investments that were made in Oregon, the energy that these projects generated, and the long-term return on the investment is substantial. However, as we all know, BETSI was leveraged beyond its intended purpose several times. While we attempted to adapt by creating effective rules and controls to ensure the program met the expectations placed upon us, we were not uniformly successful. Accordingly, the legislature began work to modify the program and sunset BETSI. Passage of House Bill 3562 in 2011 and House Bill 4079 in 2012 created two sunsets for the BETSI program, July 1, 2013 and July 1, 2014. The first sunset applied to projects with preliminary certifications issued before June 30, 2011 that had not begun construction prior to April 15, 2011. Projects that had begun construction by April 15, 2011 were allowed to remain eligible for BETSI tax credit until the final sunset of July 1, 2014. The experience of working through the first sunset provided valuable insight as we approached the 2014 sunset that just passed. Over the course of the last year, the Department of Energy recognized the final sunset of BETSI as its top priority. Program leads and staff were instructed that any resource that they required to successfully close out this program would be provided. We communicated with the rest of the department that the sunset was an all-hands-on-deck effort. On a weekly basis, program staff met with executive leadership at the agency to adjust strategies, to discuss communications, and to ensure seamless communication between us and project owners. By and large, one of the most consistently challenging aspects of BETSI was maintaining the balance between good customer service for those who are making multi-million dollar investments in the state and maintaining our role as providing the highest critical standards as we evaluated projects that we were to judge whether or not they qualified. We were both distributing tax credits and the agency designed to help provide the expertise and guidance necessary to ensure that they were constructed as planned. Another significant complexity during this previous year was that many of these final projects were actively looking for investors and partners. From a legal perspective, the department had to be extremely careful about what we said in the public space. we risked creating liability for the state if we were to somehow be pointed to as being responsible for an investor being a project owner being unable to identify or find an investor. All of these challenges were highlighted by projects that were eligible for the final sunset. They had been slowly developing for years, had been receiving significant public interest, and were complex from a technical or financial perspective. OTA worked to ensure that we communicated continuously with project owners, with the legislature, with the governor's office, and other stakeholders about the progress of projects. Successfully closing out Betsy first and foremost required that all interested parties understood how the process to sunset would work. Consistent communication proved to be a valuable resource as several projects that were hours or days away from finishing as we approached July 1st were actually very complimentary of the department despite the fact that the concrete hadn't dried and they were no longer eligible to receive Betsy's. Of the final 153 eligible Betsy projects, 62 were awarded tax credits totaling slightly more than $37 million. An additional $32 million in tax credits were not issued for those remaining projects that did not complete construction. Over the course of the first Betsy sunset and the last year, ODO implemented several tools it developed in an attempt to improve and strengthen the program. In 2010, ODO implemented a compliance program authorized by House Bill 3672. Prior to that, projects were not visually inspected. Staff relied on documentation as evidence that projects were constructed and completed in accordance with descriptions in the project owner's preliminary and final certifications. From July 1st, 2011, the inspection team completed on-site inspections of 697 projects and passed 624 of these, 73 failed. In the last year, the department also began to require that some project owners enter into performance agreements. These agreements are a new tool we utilize to make certain variable production projects or new technologies such as anaerobic digesters to ensure they perform for as long as expected. The performance agreements are 5 years to coincide with the length of the tax credit. These relatively new tools, our commitment to communicate with stakeholders, and our department's initial commitment to resourcing the effort completely all contributed to a relatively smooth final sunset. However, as I mentioned, we are still left with a program that is perceived largely negatively. The last 7 years have defined the Betsy program. As the Department of Energy struggled to manage Betsy, we have learned a significant amount about our capabilities, our limitations, and have already begun to implement many of the lessons learned in our existing programs. We have learned from our past mistakes. However, so much of what we did continues to impact the Department of Energy. We are fully aware that we have a long road to walk to regain the legislature and the public's confidence. Let me begin by saying that we should have checked in more regularly as we shifted strategy in 2007. No matter how well you write laws, no matter how well we develop rules, and then create processes to make both come to life, challenges only become apparent in practice. As we implemented the new Betsy strategy, how the program was being utilized should have been more proactively communicated. With Betsy, we were largely reactive. Unacceptably, we consistently surprised many of our important stakeholders. We also struggled with the size and sophistication of a relatively, or you know, essentially a new program. Though we were properly staffed, we thought of Betsy in two-year cycles. We often asked for limited duration positions to staff the program. As a result, we had a lot of turnover, we lost institutional knowledge, we were unable to maintain consistency among our staff. It made enforcing and following and administering the program that much more difficult. As a department, we should have done a better job of anticipating this need and adjusted accordingly. We also realize now that Betsy required us to focus on criteria largely outside of our area of expertise. We issued tax credits based on the cost of building a project. We are not construction or project managers. Our expertise is energy. In the future, we hope to be stewards of incentives with qualifications that are and criteria that are mission-based. We should be evaluating energy production and savings and encouraging the creation of projects that move us closer to accomplishing the state's energy goals. We also struggled with creating effective mechanisms to claw back tax credits that were issued. Our authority to recover Betsy's existed only in cases of fraud and misrepresentation, which turns out to be an extremely high threshold and bar to meet. I do not know if we would have exercised additional clawback authority, but I do know the leverage to do so would have been an incredibly powerful tool as we negotiated the Betsy process. We should have anticipated needing more aggressive enforcement mechanisms as we develop the Betsy program. Additionally, as we struggled to get a a consistent handle on the program, we were reactive and changed complex rules too frequently and without proper regard for long-term impact. We put the rule, we developed rules that were difficult to enforce at best, and layer upon layer of them made the program ambiguous and difficult to administer as time passed. We also should have created and utilized performance agreements sooner. Producing or saving energy that our investment is predicated on is our goal. Utilizing them this past year was a good thing, but we certainly should have developed them earlier. As a department, we must develop and use tools to protect the state's investment on a go-forward basis more aggressively. Among other important lessons we have learned is the value and necessity of reliable and comprehensive data. To this day, even in preparation of this testimony, we continue to struggle with Betsy data. We did not ensure consistent data integrity. As a department, we are often left having to piece Betsy data together rather than rely on it for valuable insight. Data we collect, how we collect it, why we collect it, and the way in which we present it are ongoing lessons that we remain committed to implementing. Finally, and most importantly, we lost the confidence of the legislature and much of the public. We communicated poorly. A handful of the decisions we made among thousands were defined as questionable at best and incorrect at worst. Those questionable decisions have defined 35 years of a relatively successful program. We were left consistently on the defensive and never emerged. We lost and are working to regain trust. Anecdotally, I can tell you it is nearly impossible for me to discuss the Department of Energy with anyone without having to quickly talk about wind farms and tax credits. We have, can, and do other valuable work on behalf of the state. The best I can do today is offer the department's commitment to not repeat these mistakes. In closing, we are eager to move on and to do so utilizing the wisdom we have gained. Tax credits remain one of the most effective tools we have at our disposal to promote and ensure consistent and proactive movement toward an even more effective and sustainable energy future in Oregon. We are committed to regaining the trust of this legislative body and the public in our ability to utilize them going forward. We want you to be proud of the work that we do on behalf of Oregonians. Thank you. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Madam Chair.
What a breath of fresh air. I sat here for session after session and got stonewalled, got lack of information. There was a brief period when Mark Long was the director where we had the same kind of can-do attitude, same kind of transparency. We frankly wouldn't have gotten where we got without him. And I'm very gratified to hear the whole tone of your presentation, and I want you to know that we are here to help you along those lines, and I just want to encourage you to keep up the transparency and keep up with the addressing the problems that you have very articulately identified. And I also wanted to ask you, how long have you been acting director?
Chair Barnhart, Representative, members of the committee, Senator Burdick, I have been acting director since May. I appreciate your comments very much. We know we have a lot of work to do. I think the department is full of people who are committed to ensuring that we are on the right road. They're working very, very hard every day. We know we have a lot of ground to cover, but I think we're definitely on the path forward. So thank you very much.
Well, I let me simply echo that. Senator Burdick and I sat through a lot of those hearings. It is clear, isn't it, that the entire process that we used from the beginning in 2007 was significantly flawed. Nobody knew that at the time. We wouldn't have done it had we known that it was significantly flawed. I appreciate, I think I'm repeating what she said, but I appreciate very much the awareness of the department's contribution to the difficulties we had. I think we have to figure out a pretty complex set of issues at this point. I'm personally committed to significantly reducing Oregon's carbon emissions over the long haul, and hopefully shorter than the long haul. I'm very conflicted on how to do that, what the best approach is. we've used the carrot approach. We've had a stick approach with the renewable portfolio standards and things of that sort. Figuring out exactly what mechanisms are going to work best to accomplish that, and I don't think are at all clear. Getting the best information possible from your department and from other places about what the actual effects of the various things we've tried to do are, I think would be very helpful as we look forward to our future policies. And I'm hoping that we are able to actually make a significant contribution toward the incentives and disincentives necessary to move us to the new energy world in the next session. I'm hoping we get there. So I completely agree with Chair Burdick's comment, and maybe I have a slightly different bent on what that means to me personally, and I appreciate it very much. Other questions, comments? I will consider your letter as an invitation to get a whole lot more involved in the nitty-gritty of how we write legislation in the future, if that's what you had in mind.
Chair Barnhart, representative of the committee, that is absolutely what we had in mind. I will say it takes a tremendous amount of courage to come up and continue to talk about Betsy, so I'm not going to take your invitation to talk about carbon emissions right now.
That's fine. That's fine.
However, we do want to be partners. That is absolutely the goal we want.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, another opportunity that Betsy has ultimately provided to the Department of Energy is that we are a more sophisticated agency now. Yeah. 7 years ago, we were a much smaller shop.
Yeah.
We've now been through the fire a little bit. I think that we have more experience to take on some of these bigger issues. We understand now the political, the financial, and the public pressure that comes with this new sort of level of responsibility. So we're preparing for it.
Well, and in 2008 or 2009, the committees became very aware that was an issue. But it takes a long time to make a shift in a department. It takes a significant time to do that. I now understand much better what you mean when you said that you also were assigned the short straw today. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
If that is all, do we have other things for the good of the order, Paul, that we need to deal with before we adjourn?
Mr. Chair, just the one comment is that we have a meeting September 15th. From 8 to 11, September 15th, so Monday morning. So we're the first out of the chute for legislative days. And we are going to be meeting jointly, the two committees. We will have an agenda posted shortly, a formal agenda. So look for that. But make sure you have in your calendar Monday the 15th from 8 to 11.
Great. Anything else? Yes, Representative Nose.
Say, thanks for having me here. And it was very, very interesting. I learned a lot. I have a lot more to learn, but it was very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Taxes are fascinating.
They are.
Irritating and appalling all at the same time. And it's interesting that you've figured that out already. with that, I guess we're ready to adjourn. The House Committee on Revenue stands adjourned. We'll see you in September.
Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is adjourned.
Okay.
Does the
Okay.
Does the
Okay.